Lamed Amud Aleph,
page 30A3 in the Schottenstein edition of Kiddushin. You will perhaps remember that we are in the middle of a discussion about the importance of the study of Torah. That is a product of a baraita that happened several pages before, which defined the responsibilities of a father toward a son. One of those responsibilities was the teaching of Torah. And once the Gemara tries to flesh out what that actually means, it can't leave the subject of the study of Torah without sitting on it for a while and talking and praising the values, many values of the study of Torah. One of the things that we learned, just about the last thing that we did at our last session, was that we saw that the Gemara says, since it says, Vishinantam Levanecha, you shall teach them to your children. We learned that the it could have said it in a more specific way in terms of the repetition. It could have said, you shall do it twice, because the word shinantam seems to come from the word sheni, shnayim, twice. And the Gemara learns from this that since it doesn't say it as it might have said it, in fact, there are three. You should not repeat something twice, but three times. And then Tigmara says, well, not three times, but you should divide your study into three sections. You should study the scriptures, and you should study the Mishnah, and you should study the Gemara. And then the question was, well, does that mean you should spend a third of the year in each? Gemara finally concludes, no, it means a third of the day, or each day you should study each three, all three. And remember, the last thing that we did is we looked at the daily prayer book. And in the early morning prayers, there is a blessing for the study of Torah, followed by a scriptural passage, followed by a passage from the Mishnah, followed by a passage from the Gemara, so that we actually have in our daily prayers. We've structured it so that we do what the Gemara is speaking about in the last passage that we read. Then briefly, we went on, and this is now at the first real paragraph in 30A3, Lefichach nikra'u rishonim sofrim. In a very loosely logical fashion, and let me say, the fact that we've been talking about dividing the day up into three, and we were talking about the number three, and that three was relevant to Torah study, and that it was relevant to Torah study because it wasn't only two, but it was three, well, we immediately find ourselves in numbers. And Gemara then says, "Lifichach nikra'u rishonim sofrim." Therefore, the whole subject of numbers actually is relevant to the study of the Torah, and therefore, the first of the sages were called for that reason, sofrim. Now, sofrim we normally understand to mean a sage or somebody who writes a scroll as a sofer, but the Hebrew word lispor, which is the root of that, means to count. It means to count. So in fact, there's a relation between counting and Torah study. We just saw it in one way, the threes, and the twos, and so on. But here it's going to actually go on to focus on the actual counting of verses. And this we did last time. We did this paragraph, but I'll start there because otherwise you can't understand what's going to happen. Therefore, the early teachers were called sofrim. Shahayu sofrim, because, why were they called sofrim? Because they used to count kola otyot shabatorah, all of the letters in the Torah. Right? That's one of the things that they did. They counted. Shahayu omrim, for we have a tradition that they used to say, Vav de Gachon, the Vav in the middle of the word Gachon, which you can see in the note is Leviticus 11:42, Kol Holech Al Gachon Lo Tochlum Ki Sheketzein. Every animal, every creature that creeps on its belly, you shall not eat them, for they are an abomination. So that's Gachon. Okay, that's Parshat Shmini, roughly in the middle, sort of in the middle of the book of Leviticus. In fact, if you count all the letters of the Torah, the Vav in the middle of the word Gachon is the middle letter of the whole Torah. Now, you may not have known that, but that's why we have Sofrim. The Sofrim, the early teachers, did things like that. They counted up all the letters.
But why?
Why not?
There's a lot of time.
Why not?
I would think.
Question. People do a lot of crazier things every day.
Isn't it marked in the text?
Well, we do. In many editions, in our edition, in the Herz Chumash, for example, at the end of each of the five books, at least in the Hebrew, I don't think it's translated into the English, it is noted that there are so many verses and so many letters and so many things.
The statistics
are put
but
in there.
I think that Vav is...
Oh, that is Vav. Correct. It's a big Vav.
It's a big Vav.
Good for you. Very good.
What's the point, though, of counting the verse of the letters especially? What is the point of doing that?
Why not do it?
Why not? Okay.
Don't you want to know how many letters there are in the Torah?
I think it's a hashing form, like to ensure that nothing is omitted.
Well, yeah. We're going to see in just a moment that's quite right. Just keep in mind for the moment that we're doing it. Let's just see what else we're counting. Vav de Gachon, Chetzion Shel Otiot Shel Sefer Torah. That's what we said. Darosh Darash, the words Darosh Darash, here, look in the note 25, Leviticus 10:16, Ve'et Se'ir HaChatat Darosh Darash Moshe V'inei Soraf, Moses inquired about the he-goat of the sin offering, for behold, it had been burned. Darosh Darash. The words Darosh Darash, Chetzian Shel Tevot. They are the middle of the number of words. So the Vav and Gachon was if you count all the letters. Darosh Darash is the middle of all of the words. Vehid Galach. And the verse that begins with the word Vehit Kalach, and that's Leviticus 13:33, about a netek, a type of an illness, and you have to cut the hair off it. Vehit Kalach. The verse beginning with Hit Kalach Shel Psukim. That is the middle verse of the whole Torah. Okay. Then it goes on to describe the similar types of counting in the book of Psalms. Yichar semina chazir miya'ar. In the verse, or the passage, Yichar semina chazir miya'ar, which means the boar of the forest ravages it. Ayin diyaar, the letter ayin in the middle of the word yaar is chetzian shel tehilim. That's the middle of the letters of the book of Tehillim, of the book of Psalms. V'hurachum echaper avon, and the phrase v'hurachum echaper avon, chetzio dipsukim. That's the middle verse of the book of Psalms. Okay? So that we read already in December. Now, Rav Yosef is now going to analyze or ponder what we have just read. Vav de Gachon. When we make reference to the Vav of the word Gachon, Mehaigisa o Mehaigisa. If we say that it is the middle, do we mean it is the middle from the first side or from the last side, the second side? Anything that's in the middle. Right. Now, we don't know exactly what that means. It could be that there's an even number. And when we say that it's in the middle, it means it's the end of the first half of the even number. And then there's perhaps another middle for the second half, which is an even number of letters. Or it could be that there are an odd number of letters, and it's the exact middle. So far we don't really know. We don't know what's being referred to. So that's he's reflecting on. Now, Haigisa Ome Haigisa. Is it part of this side of the, on the other side of the Torah's letters? Amru Le, they said to him, Nete Sefer Torah Ve'im Ninhu. Let's take a Sefer Torah and we'll count them. Oh, that's a good idea. All right. If you're wondering, you know, you have an old Brita because this is very old stuff. Remember, these are the early, the Sofrim are the early teachers. Early teachers means that we're reflecting now on the time of Ezra the Sofer. Ezra the Sofer. Ezra the Sofer is roughly 500 BCE. Talmudic period begins about 200 BCE. So this is way before even the beginning of the Talmud, in the earliest pieces of the Talmud. And most of the Talmud is from the year zero plus. So we're really going way, way, way back. So these are traditions of the early Sofrim, of the very earliest of the rabbis. And there are these traditions, and one needs to perhaps verify them, or at least flesh them out, and see, in fact, whether you're counting from the beginning or counting from the end. So he says, let's take a Sefer Torah, and we'll count them. Mi lo amar Rabba Bar Chana? Did not Rabba Bar Chana once say, lo zazu misham ad shehiviu Sefer Torah umina They didn't move from there until they brought a Sefer Torah and they counted the whole thing out. And we don't know exactly what that was in relation to, but it was probably something like this. So whatever that piece of teaching is brought in relation to the question which Rav Yosef asked. Amar Laho, Rav Yosef now says in response to this suggestion that they count all the letters of the Sefer Torah, In hu bikiye b'chaserot v'yeterot, they were well versed in the knowledge of chaserot v'yeterot. Chaserot and yeterot are, in Hebrew, there are a number of letters that may or may not appear, and you know to read them as there, if they are there or not. For example, the most common one is the Vav. Okay? A Vav which has an O sound. Now, you know a Vav can sometimes sound like a V sound, or sometimes it can be a vowel. Now, there are times when the Vav does not appear. But if you know the language, you have to pronounce it anyway. So when do you put in the Vav and when do you not put in the Vav? And the truth is, we don't really know. I mean, we now have certain modern conventions for this, but we really don't know when it was originally put in, when it wasn't put in. Sometimes it was there and sometimes it wasn't there. In fact, if you read the Torah, you'll see that it's not consistent. There's not perfect consistency in the use of the Vav. Same thing is true occasionally with the Yud. The word Yerushalayim, for example. Yerushalayim is spelled... The last Yud in the Bible doesn't appear. All right? In modern language, it does appear. So when you include these things, we do not include them. So here, Rav Yosef says, in who they, these other teachers, they were knowledgeable about when to include these things that are sometimes included and sometimes not included. We are no longer knowledgeable about that. So, in other words, the Torahs that we have may not be as accurate as their Torahs, because after all, we have a Torah. Now, the fact is very interesting that they're saying this. You might have assumed that all Torahs were always assumed to be exactly the same. This reveals the fact that at least at that particular period in time, that was not considered to be the case. That there was a variance, there were subtle variances, but there were some variances in the details of the way in which the Sefer Torah were written. Okay?
Well, one would assume that there were a required number of letters in the Torah since they had been counted. by then, and shouldn't that be a requirement?
Well, that could be what Meir has said before. It could be that, in fact, the purpose of doing it is for the purpose of accuracy. In fact, it's a spell check. I mean, it's at least a very primitive type of, you know, you have to have the right number of letters, and it's very hard to proofread. But one way that at least gives you some sense of whether you might be correct is whether you have the right number of letters.
And then so how do you know what you left out if it's not the right number?
Then well, then you're in trouble, right? Then you've got to search. But you may have a fair reason to not have to do such a detailed search if you end up with the right correct number of numbers of letters. So that may be the reason for it. So you have an early tradition of the number of letters, but here we see at a later time, they're not sure that that's accurate anymore, or at least the Sefer Torah that we're dealing with comport with what we learned earlier on. Now, I would have expected them to give us some new figures. They don't do that. They don't do that. So my assumption is that at this period of time, middle rabbinic period of time, this was not yet so clear. In fact, we know by the 10th century, we have a group of people who, in fact, take this all extremely seriously for the entire Bible, and they're called the Masoretes. The text that we have of the Bible is called the Masoretic text, because, in fact, there were people at that particular period of time who were very concerned about the purity of the scriptural text and made it their business to specialize in this. Finally, the text that we have today is the Masoretic text. We have even fairly accurate copies of the Masoretic text. You can see the best that we have, the Aleppo Codex, is available in the Israel Museum, in the Shrine of the Book. They have as much of the Aleppo Codex. There was a piece of it, I think, here at the Jewish Museum. It may still be here.
We saw it at the Shrine of the Book.
The Shrine of the Book has the Aleppo Codex. I just saw it a few months ago. I went over there just because I wanted to take a look at it. And that was the text that was seen by Maimonides. It was the text that was preserved in Aleppo in Syria. Aleppo in Hebrew is Aram Tzova. It was the oldest edition of the full biblical text and is the best known that we have that preserves the Masoretic, whatever the Masoretes decided was the correct form of the text.
I think it's the Leningrad. The difference between the two, I was told, is that the Aleppo text wasn't complete. The missing part was burned.
The Aleppo text is incomplete.
Yeah, the Leningrad text is the oldest complete text dated that we have.
The Leningrad Codex, which I actually have upstairs in the office, I wanted to keep one around.
That's the DBD text.
There's going to be a new edition of the DBD that's coming out, which will fix up some of the things in the based on the Leningrad text. That is as good a text as we have, as a complete text.
Right.
But the Aleppo text is the best text, but it's not complete.
Right.
It was not complete because of the post-1948 riots in Aleppo. The synagogue was attacked in Aleppo by the Arabs. And as a result of that, it wasn't known, it was thought that the whole Aleppo text had been destroyed. Turned up later in Israel, but incomplete. And they don't know what happened to the missing leaves of the Aleppo text. It may be that they were just destroyed, or it may be that they're in somebody's drawer somewhere, and we just don't know. So that's a current mystery in the history of the text. Yes?
So with this counting of the letters, has there been much written about the process of how that was done?
Well, it's not such a hard thing to do. I mean, you can just particularly people who are numbers people. To this day, some people are numbers people, some people are not. There are people who can very quickly do these kinds of computations and like to do it. It's a form of amusement, and they enjoy the sense of accuracy and putting that kind of stuff together.
So they just say it with the pointer, and then somebody on the side would say, he'd say the number, and they'd write it down?
I couldn't tell you. I know people in this shul who could do it. And I assume it's the same kind of people. Some of them were sitting in our meeting this morning. But we have numbers people in the show. God bless them. It's a pleasure to see the way some people can handle numbers.
Is one thing, but counting something.
These people
and coming
do
up with a number is something.
I tell you, there are all kinds of people. People have different talents.
I don't mean to obsess on this, but we have three.
Oh, why not?
Well, I suppose. Well, aren't we doing that anyway? We have three references to counting: the middle letter, the middle word, and the middle phrase.
Right.
Isn't that enough information to be able to definitively say, you know, this is the right number of words, and we know what the middle word is, the middle phrase is. So shouldn't there be a way to know from this point on back the accuracy of this?
But if you're not sure where to put in the vavs, for example, you may, yes, but it's artificial in a way. You can just add enough vavs to make this thing be in the middle. You don't actually know that it's an accurate text.
But how about a phrase would at least be approximate?
Well, but that's interesting too. No, you're right. I mean, the fact, the more you expand this, the more you expand to beyond that, to not only letters, but remember, so far we're only discussing the vav. So far the only thing that has been raised here where he says go count it is the letters. Okay? But what you are, the question that you are raising is as far as the other two categories go. As you expand the number of things, you decrease the number of possibilities, in fact. You decrease the variability. And that's going to, the Gemara is going to bring that up shortly.
So when a new Torah is created, how is that certified as being correct?
Well,
And what version is used to make them?
The version that is used, every Sefer Torah, certainly for the last 1,100 years, is based on the Masoretic text. Okay? So there's absolute uniformity in Sifrei Torah. And just given the realities of any evidence we have, all of the evidence, as far as Sifrei Torah goes, realize that the things we have in the Dead Sea Scrolls are not... There's some Torah. Most of it is not Torah. It's later books. It's the book of Isaiah. Isaiah is the principal text in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So I think there is some Deuteronomy. But that's far from a decent source. And you don't even know whether those were accurate.
Right.
There's no reason to assume that they were accurate, because it could be they were library copies, and they weren't sacred copies. The idea that there should be a sacred copy that is the copy from which everybody else has to copy from, there's no reason to assume that what the Dead Sea Scrolls were that. We have no evidence that they were that. So the oldest sources that we have are this Aleppo Codex, and more than that, we don't know. We just don't know.
But look how good they were, okay, in terms of doing it, because this copies of the Torah, which go back for thousands of years, okay, the basic meanings and so much of it hasn't changed, the vast majority. I mean, there's little letters and little variant and sentences here and there, you know, but basically the book has remained the same, all because of these guys.
Oh, of course, absolutely. Let's keep going. I don't want to reflect too much on that yet. Let's read a little bit more, because what you said is so true that it gets to be more true the more we read the Gemara. So let's take a look at that. Similarly, by Rav Yosef, Rav Yosef is the person that has been asking now, asked the previous question. He has a follow-up question. The Hidgalach, right? The verse that contains Hidgalach, which was said to be the midpoint of the Torah's verses, Mehagisa or Mehagisa? Same question is asked. Is it the middle from the front side or from the middle from the back side? Which side? So the analysis is exactly the same. Amale Abaye, Psukim Mia Leto Lemimne. Verses, at least, we can count. Because with verses, you don't have the problem of the chaser, of the vav, that's sometimes there and sometimes not there. All the verses are going to be there, so we'll know that they're there. Okay? So Rav Yosef says, Bifsukinami labakeinan. Very interesting. Even in verses, we are not expert. Dechi atar of Acha bar Ada. For when Acha bar Ada came to Babylonia from Israel, Amar, he says, Amar b'mar rava paske le lahai kra li tlata psuke. There in the land of Israel, they divide the following verse of the scriptures into three verses. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe anochi ba elecha be'av he'anan. God said to Moses, Behold, I shall come to you in the thickness of a cloud. In the land of Israel, that was three verses. Okay? And in Babylonia, in the text that we have, it's one verse. Now, this too is rather startling. One would have assumed that the number of verses was clear. But it's not clear. In fact, the whole division of the scriptural text into verses, as you well know when you read a Torah, you don't know where the verse ends. So that all of that is dependent upon tradition. And obviously, again, here in the, what I call the middle Talmudic period, we're now in about the middle of the 3rd century, early 4th century, at that particular CE, that particular period of time, there were variants. There were variants in the way the versification was done. You know that even the numerology of the verses, the Genesis 1:16 and so on, that's largely the contribution of the Christians. We Jews have accepted the way they have done it, although we don't always do the same thing. We don't know, but the general concept of chapter and verse was a Christian contribution to the way in which the scriptural text was studied. Sometimes it's noticeably different. The Ten Commandments, for example, we have different way of numbering the Ten Commandments, the Jews and the Christians. But here again, there is an indeterminacy that one might not have expected. One might have assumed that all of this was absolutely clear, and that in order to have a sacred text, that one would see in the discussions of that sacred text, that the discussions themselves would presuppose that there was one text that everybody knew. Here you see that there is no such assumption. There's no such assumption. So that I think that, you know, even on a theological level, some people have said to me, for example, when you say "Vizot haTorah asher sam Moshe lifnei bnei Yisrael al pi Hashem biyad Moshe," okay, that's what we say when the Torah is lifted. Right. So I've had people come to me and say, you know, I don't really believe that. I don't believe the whole Torah came from Moses. Oh, it's an interesting theological issue. Right? That's a basic issue in Jewish theology. Does the whole Torah come from Moses? Does it not? Right? Or Torah Misinai, does the whole Torah come from Sinai? Or does it not? No, I think thoughtful Jews will kind of wonder about that and will want to have a point of view. And traditional point of view is Zota Torah Shesa Moshe. It's explicit there. This is the Torah which Moses placed before the people of Israel that God gave to him beyond Moshe in the hand of Moses. Okay. It's fascinating to me that, of course, in the Talmud they were not sure. You're going to say Zota Torah. This is it. They don't know that that's it. It maybe had an extra vav, maybe it didn't have a vav. Maybe it had a yud, maybe it didn't have a yud. Maybe the psukim, the verses were divided in one way, maybe they're divided in another way. I think that's fantastic, to tell you the truth. What it means is that in what we would have assumed was something that is highly specific. As for example, if you ever debate Bible with a Christian, and you have them discuss, debate with you the meaning of a scriptural verse, they usually will do it in English, for example. And the English meaning of the verse is absolutely what it means. But if you know Hebrew, first of all, you know that Hebrew is a relatively indeterminate language.
Is a relatively what?
Indeterminate language. It is not a specific language. Hebrew often leaves things unsaid. And it could be interpreted one way, it could be interpreted another way, a third way, a fourth way, a fifth way, wide variety of possibilities, which is why the process of biblical commentary is so central to our reading of the scriptures. Biblical commentary is, for us, second nature. We can't read it without commentaries. Because we know that it doesn't mean one thing. It depends on how you read it. And therefore we are enriched by a variety of readings. To a certain type of theological mind, that's intolerable. Because if there is a truth, it must be absolute and clear. I'm using this passage to say to you that I think that even our notion of the divinity of the text is not as precise as you might think. And I don't think that that's a problem. I think that that's a plus, not a minus. I think it's a plus. The same way that the ability to interpret text is not a minus, but a plus. It really allows for much greater creativity. It allows for much greater responsiveness. And I think that what this allows for is also for error. Error. Error does not do away with the divinity of text. Some people would argue that if you have a divine text, it must be a perfect text. And the fact that it's imperfect takes away from its divinity. I'm telling you that here the rabbis of the Talmud are certainly convinced of its divinity and equally is convinced of its imperfection. Okay? Yes?
I'm just wondering, how do we know one way or the other whether the Torah was given in Hebrew and Aramaic?
Well, we assume from what we know that the text itself is the text, that we are not dealing with a translated text. That's always been the assumption of the readers of the text. To the, some extent, the text supports it, but it has a limit to the amount of evidence that you have for such an assumption. As opposed to, for example, the Christian scriptures. Christian scriptures, the New Testament, is assumed by those who take it to be sacred as being a translated text.
From what?
It was translated probably from Aramaic into Greek.
No.
Into Greek. And therefore, one of the things that people have tried to do is to establish an urtext, an original text of the New Testament. Because there is no original text of the New Testament. It doesn't exist. It only exists in early translation, the translation to Greek. Okay? So our scriptures are really very different. The theological issues of a New Testament scholar are essentially different than the theological issues of an Old Testament scholar, as it were. And I think it has to do with the nature of accuracy and indeterminacy in the text itself.
I wonder when we talk about this search for the truth, the search for the original text, is there a difference between an archaeological approach and a theological approach?
Well, I think that there essentially is, because I'll give you the following example, which I enjoy giving. News report came out of the Sinai yesterday. A CD was found. A CD was found on the foot of Mount Sinai, what seems to be the foot of Mount Sinai, with an accurate recording of the revelation to Moses. Let's take that news report and see what we can make of it. Your obvious reaction to the news report is it's ridiculous. It's anachronistic. Right? It's anachronistic. It's sort of fascinating. It's humorous. But essentially, as a scientific proof, it's anachronistic. That's exactly my point. In fact, we presuppose that it is possible to have certain types of evidence. I would argue that it is not possible to have certain types of evidence. And in fact, any evidence, we even see this in archaeology every single day. Archaeologists discover something. So in the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, the archaeologists had discovered, and the archaeologists said, this proves what the Bible says. This is exactly what the Bible says. 6 cubits from here, 8 cubits from there. We went 6 cubits, we went 8 cubits, we dug down, we found what the Bible said you're going to find. The guy from Tel Aviv University says, you're making it up. How do you... The Bible is not true. Why should the Bible be true? The fact that you found this, it's one of these lucky things that happens to people. You know, it... You could find it also on Broadway. You could find certain things that could just happen. There's no proof. Who's right? Who's right? If it's an evidentiary question, you know, to what extent do you trust your evidence? And you have two levels of evidence. One evidence is what you found in the ground. The other evidence is what the scriptures say. All right? My own predilection is to assume that the both of them will pretty much say the same thing. But frankly, that predilection is not based on much evidence. It's based on a religious tradition and the continuity of that tradition, not on evidence. Not on evidence. So you mean to say religion is not based on evidence? Maybe that's right. Religion is rather based on tradition and not evidence. And to some extent, evidence may be corroborating, or may not be corroborating. Amazing thing is that it's as corroborating as it turns out to be. That's really the amazing thing. But it doesn't depend upon the corroboration, because really, its significance comes before the corroboration.
Because of that, it's even more remarkable that one person, or however it was done, can translate the New Testament as straightforward, this is what it says, no questions asked, this is the word. I mean, was there some, there was no debate then? Do we know anything about how that process was done and you know, what the veracity of that knowledge is?
I don't really know the answer to that question. I would just say that New Testament scholars do ask those questions. They are aware of the scientific issues in their own scriptures, and they do therefore address these issues.
I do know that the early Christian translators of the the Bible, Origen and Saint Jerome, that were translating the Hebrew Bible into Greek. The reason that they were doing it, was to make a link to us. They wanted to get back to prove that versus all of the other heathen religions around, they were closest to us. And so they were searching for the same truth, through us to get back to the beginning.
But they have another reason for doing it too, though, which is partly to see the Old Testament as being the source...
Stepping stone.
The stepping stone to the New Testament, right. So that to them there's... one serves the other, but the old serves the new. That's a clear set of priorities that they have. Okay. Let's go on a little bit further, and you'll see just even a little bit more of this. Danu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught. Now here we have a baraita in a relatively the same subject. It's edited in here on the subject. Chameshet alafim ushmone ma'ot ushmonim ushmone psukim ayu psukei sefer Torah. Right? 5,888 is the number of verses in a Torah. Right? Again, you probably hadn't counted that, but that's the number in the Baraita. Okay? Now look at this. Yater alav tehilim shmona. The book of Psalms has 8 more verses than this. Chaser mimenu divrei hayamim shmona. And the book of Chronicles has 8 less than this. Now, look at this baraita. You may not be experts in the book of Psalms, but let me just tell you that, first of all, there are 150 Psalms. Average 20 verses a psalm or so. I think if you have any sense of the length of things, you will immediately have the reaction that this can't possibly be true. A Chumash is much longer than the book of Psalms. It's just much bigger. So here again is another very difficult way of understanding this, because the only way that it can make sense is that either the book of Psalms was divided up into completely different verses than the verses that we have, or the Chumash was divided into completely different verses than the verses we have, or both. Okay? That's the only way that you could possibly have a differential between the two of 8 verses.
But the book of Psalms could be short sentences, very short sentences, so...
It could be, but, I mean, it's not hard to figure that out.
We don't have all the Psalms.
Maybe that's it. All right, that's it. It's another possibility. Or we don't have the whole Torah. I don't, you know, it's yet another possibility. But I'm just showing you here, you have a baraita. A baraita is something of, you know, that's a main line. And it is simply reinforcing the notion that the division of the scriptural text into verses was certainly indeterminate at that period of time. It was either not clear, or it was different from what we have, or the psalm text, or something like that. But it doesn't hold together in terms of the knowledge of what we have today. Okay? Questions? Yes?
I was just referring to one of your previous explanatory comments. That is why religion is defined as a belief.
Hear, hear. Thank you. You're right. Correct. Okay. Yes, Robert.
This idea that the text itself not has many versions, but different people looking at the same text are seeing different things.
Right.
They're counting differently. They're
right.
This is a very, you might say, this is a quantum mechanical approach to Torah exegesis.
It says, tell me what you mean by that.
Well, it says that what you're observing is not fixed, cannot be seen by everybody at all times as having the same value.
Uh-huh.
It's dependent on who's looking, when he's looking, where he's looking at it from.
Uh-huh.
And I think there's many other things in Torah that kind of, I mean, I know a lot of scientists see these things as absurd, but sometimes you get the feeling that these guys were way ahead of thinking.
I think that's correct. I sometimes wonder, you know, as I was saying earlier, the type of mind. Now, before you had astrophysics, what did the people who are astrophysicists do? They did this. That's what they did.
Professors at Caltech.
Correct. So,
in Bereshit, nowadays people focus on the idea of creation, 7 days, what about Darwin and so on. But I always felt that the most interesting part, and the hardest to understand, is that before creation, there was nothing. It wasn't space, wasn't dark, has no definition. So that's also modern physics tells you that's really before Big Bang. It's not like particles coalesced. There was nothing before that. So maybe there's a lot of other very interesting ideas not ideas, but ways of seeing the world that one should be looking in the Talmud to see how would their brains work.
Because
apparently they had the same sharp, keen way of looking at them. They're not surprised. They don't express any kind of annoyance or irritation. In fact, the statement, "We just can't determine it," is, from our point of view today in the 21st century, it's
that's
the
a modern
most
idea.
Sophisticated way of
exactly. Experience. Very modern idea, exactly. Bill?
In this Baraita we're just thinking about, when it talks about the number of verses in the Torah scroll, and then it has it in the Psalms and Book of Chronicles, why isn't that considered to be much more accurate than we have our notion today, since it's so much closer to when you'd have your Torah scroll, when the Torah scroll was generated, if you want to talk about it, or the Book of Psalms or the Book of Chronicles. In other words, why isn't this more accurate than our notion of how large the Book of Psalms is or the Book of Chronicles?
Mm-hmm. I honestly don't know whether this is an accurate figure. I'm assuming that it is.
Right.
I'm assuming that it is. This 5,888, that in fact that is the number of verses even today in the Sefer Torah. Although I honestly don't know.
Right. But it's more accurate than we know.
Than what we know, we would assume.
Because they were closer to it.
Right.
Yeah.
Unless there were, well, we don't see any differences. I mean, if there were differences of opinion, it'd be one thing. But at least in this passage, there is no argument on that fact. Mm-hmm. It seems to be an accepted fact. You're right. You're right.
Mm-hmm. Rabbi.
Yeah.
I think I have a problem in thinking about this. I mean, when you go back to what the basic purpose of this is, okay, you know, when I go to a Chumash sometimes, or most of the time, I always go to say, well, let's see what God had to say about this. And what we're saying here is that God is saying different things to different people, or is it God is saying the same things and people understand it differently?
I would say the latter. The latter, because when we read something, we assume we're all reading the same thing. To some extent, we are. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, we're not.
That's right.
Because we're all not the same.
We bring our own experience
exactly,
to it.
Exactly, we bring our own experience to it. That having been said, it's not as if we're making up everything that we're doing. We really need to presuppose that we have a common text. Let's just use the word that we're dealing with. That we need to have a common text, and that's extremely important for us, because otherwise we have nothing in common. Because we are all different, and we all have our own perceptions. Which is one of the reasons why I believe that it is so important in the Jewish community to have a common text. And for the community to accept the common text, it doesn't limit us from our interpretation of the text. But if we don't have a common text, then we have nothing in common. Right? So the common text, I think, is a sine qua non for the life community.
Having a common text does not imply, though, that this was the text.
I would say to the sophisticated among us, you're right. I wouldn't want to make that argument to too many people, though, because I think that most people can't take an argument like that. They need to assume that it must be the same text, or else it can't be a common text, and it can't be a valid text. But I tried to prove to you from what we've just read, at least the rabbis of the Talmud don't have that need, and they're able to tolerate these what they call imprecisions.
You made a reference to a sacred copy of the Torah and a library copy.
Correct.
Of the Torah. Sometimes you have the feeling here that they handle copies of the Torah differently from the way we do, maybe more like we handle a printed version.
That's correct. I think you're right. I
remember in Moed Katan, there was some question, did he have a Torah lying on his bed?
Right, remember that? Or did he have a Torah lying on his bed? Correct.
Or something. Right. So did they handle it? We don't know.
We don't know. I mean, we really don't. Even when we read that material, I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know whether it means a Sefer Torah or does it mean a Chumash. To us, those are two different things. To them, they weren't necessarily, but maybe they were. I honestly just don't know.
Well, it all would have been written by hand.
Because it's all written by hand. Before the printing press, it's all written by hand. So it's just hard to know. We don't have evidence.
They probably have to go through the same kind of proofing, irrespective of what the ultimate purpose of
it is. Well, I would think you'd need more proofing if it were a sacred text.
Okay.
Because the other texts could have mistakes.
And would be tolerated.
Probably. I don't know for sure, but I would think there would be a distinction between the two.
But when they started to do the counting and statistics, for the point of statistic, I understand the reason to do it. But I don't know if they really started to do that to look for different mashma'ut within the numbers that they will get.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I don't know the answer to that.
And then they found nothing and it left like that. But if there really was there something.
Could be.
What's
it could
mashma'ut?
Be. Mashma'ut, the meaning. Meaning. Numerology eventually becomes a major way of studying the Torah. Whether the counting of these things is some level of what we later know as numerology, whether there's, let's say, a mystery having to do with the numbers of things, I almost think there probably is, and that they probably did assume that. Exactly what goes beyond that, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Yeah? Okay, let's go on. 30A4. Tanu Rabbanan. We're still continuing now with the importance of the study of Torah. Tanu Rabbanan. Vishinantam. All right, was Vishinantam Levanecha. You shall teach them to your children. Remember, we went from there to the number 2 and 3, and then we went into numbers, and now we're back to Vishinantam. So that's the nice editing of the text. So Vishinantam, we know, it means, and you shall teach them to your children. But it's a little bit of an odd term, again, because it has two nuns in it. Vishinantam. Sheyehu divrei Torah mechudadim beficha. A wonderful interpretation here. That the words of the Torah should be sharp in your mouth. Because vishinantam has the word in it, shein. Shein means a tooth. In Hebrew. So here, so it should be sharp as your teeth. That's part of the implication then of Vishinantam. Not just that you should review it, but that you should be sharp with it. You should be sharp with it.
Terry Coolidge once said to me, it's almost that you should inoculate your children.
Bite them with it.
Bite them
with it. Okay? She'im yish'alecha adam davar. And here it fleshes out what the implications of this are. If a person asks you something, al tedam game. Don't stutter. In other words, know the answer. You should know it well enough so that when asked a question, you know the answer. You don't say, bah, 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 I think, well, maybe.
But sometimes you don't know the answer.
But that's because you don't know it well enough. Therefore, you should be repeating it more.
Just nod. Just whatever you do, don't murmur. Just nod. Just nod. Whatever you do, don't murmur.
Amor lo miyad. Rather, when asked the question, amor lo miyad, respond immediately. So you should know it well enough so that you know the answer right away. It's actually very, very hard to do that. Shenemar. Then you know how to do that right away. As it is said, Emor lachokhma achoti at. A very lovely verse from Shir Shirim, from the Proverbs. Say to wisdom, you are my sister. In other words, it's familiarity. Wisdom meaning Torah. And you are my sister. Velmer, and it says, Koshreim al etzbotecha kodveim al luach libecha. I tie them on your fingers. It's like tying a little knot on your finger, a string on your finger. On your fingers, write them on the tablet of your heart. It's a beautiful phrase. Tablet of your heart. V'omer, k'chitzim b'yad gibor, kein b'nei hanu'urim. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of youth. Now, arrows are sharp. Okay? Children of youth are people who are studying. They're the Talmidei Chachamim, the students of the wise. V'omer chitzei gibor shinunim. The sharp arrows of the arrows of a warrior are shinunim, sharp. Okay, shinunim, shein, tooth, vishinantam.
There's a lot of poetic license here.
That's Hebrew.
No, I'm saying
that is the essence of Hebrew, right?
Yeah, a connection between shen, tooth, and the shenen is a little bit of a stretch, but it sounds good.
That's the language.
It's the language itself.
On a funny note, in Israel, the word for hygienist, dental hygienist, is shinanit.
Shinanit.
Shinanit. So I'm thinking you could say a teacher is a shinanit. She could be a shinanit also.
It's a very new world.
Yeah, but I can take the same poetic license.
Well, how do you think modern Hebrew grew?
I know.
By the way, shnunit is what is go underwater and you shouldn't step on it. It's like the, what they call it,
coral.
Well, coral is not shnunit. It's almogus coral, huh?
The same family.
Same family, okay. Type of coral, then. Sharp curl.
Uh-huh.
Very good.
Maybe it's like teeth. It's like coming out of a mouth.
Yeah, it's like teeth. Exactly. That's what it's from, I'm sure. V'omer, Ashrei hagever Hashem milei et ashpato mehem lo yevoshu ki yedabru et oyevim bashar. Praised is the man who fills his quiver with them. They shall not be shamed when they speak with enemies in the gate. Okay, all of this now about sharpness, the assumption being that we're talking about wisdom, the children who are studying the Torah, and the Talmidei Chachamim. Now we finished, the end verse here was a verse about Ki yedabru et oyvim mashar. They shall speak with enemies in the gate. It's a little bit odd to have language about enemies in the study of Torah. But it's not as odd as you might think. As follows, Mai et oyvim bashar. What is the meaning of this enemies at the gate? What does that have to do with Torah study? Amar Rabbi Chiya bar Abba. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba says, Afilu ha'av ubano, harav v'talmido. Even a father and his son, a rabbi and his student, shoskim b'torah b'sha'ar echad, who are studying Torah in one gate, in other words, who are studying with each other, nasim oyevim zedzeh, they become enemies of one another. In other words, really good Torah study involves a lot of give and take and argument. And the argument is fast and hot and furious. And there's nothing wrong with it. That's good study. That is really good study. Ve'inam zazim misham. And they do not move from there. Ad shenaasim oavim zetzeh. Till they come to love each other. In other words, they start out arguing with each other, and at the end of the argument, they love each other. Because they appreciate the beauty of the argument. They appreciate how wonderful it was to give and to take and to try and figure out what the text is saying. And although they argue with each other because people come from different places, once they appreciate each other's points of view, they're ohavim zetzeh. They love each other. A wonderful statement about Torah study. Shenemar, and the scriptural verse is a very odd verse. Et vahev besufa. It's a very hard little piece of scripture to understand. Et vahev besufa. The note, I think, gives you the source of it. 10 here. Numbers 21:14. The full verse, I'm reading now in the note. Al kein ye'amer b'sefer milchamot Hashem et vahev besufa ve'et anichalim arnon. Therefore it will be told in the book of Hashem's wars of that which God gave on the Red Sea. That's the translation of et vahev besufa. What va meaning God, hev, natan. It's an odd in Hebrew, like havu ladunai b'nei elim. Hav means give. So vav hav, the Lord gave Bisufa Yamsuf on the Red Sea. So that's the literal translation of that phrase, but look at how it's interpreted here. Al tikre Bisufa. Do not read it Bisufa on the Red Sea. Ella bisofa, rather read it at the end. Now take a look at the Rashi here.
Sufa could be a storm. Why would it be a suf?
It could be a storm, but could be a suf. I mean, it could be a lot of things. Among the things that it could be is sof, the end. Okay.
Put the dot on top.
Look at the Rashi. Just go to the right on the Hebrew side of the page. 1, 2, 3, 4 lines down. The last three words in that line in Rashi. It says, Ed vahev besufa. Do you see that? Vahev besufa. Hachi darishla. This is how the Talmud is explaining the verse. Sefer milchamot. Right? It said, a book of wars. Oh, here's how it's interpreted. Milchama sha'al yedei sefer. You have a battle as a result of a sefer, a book. In other words, that's what it is to study. Sefer milchamot Hashem means that the study of the Lord's book leads to battles. Milchamot Hashem, okay? Sha'al yedei sefer, ahava yesh besofa. And just look at the words. At vahav besofa. At vahav is close to ahava.
Et
ahav, right. You love.
I will fall in love.
You will fall in love besofa, at the end. All right, so what begins with a battle about the book ends with being in love at the end. It's a great idea about the nature of the traditional Talmud study. It starts in a battle and it ends in friendship, in fact, in warmth. Questions, comments? Yes.
If you figure this Brita must have come from a period during Roman occupation, and how it's kind of seditious. It's a kind of sounds like they're saying, we would like to defeat you with the sharp arrows of our hero.
That's nice. Very good.
But we have only the sharp arrows, the students.
And uh-huh. That's our sharp arrows.
And we will defeat you.
Shkoch. Very nice.
As a teacher, don't you get a certain level of thrill, if you will, if you're in a debate with a student who's bringing some really interesting thought process, it may seem like it's a conflict, but at the end, it's an exercise.
Somebody once came to Orz Haruah. They said to me, Rabbi, in the middle of the service, people ask you, do they challenge you to have their disagree with you? How could they disagree with you? Doesn't that upset you? I said, it's so wonderful. People say such interesting things. I said, I don't leave every Saturday morning, go home knowing more than I did when I came in. I said, could you imagine such a wonderful thing? I said, that's so interesting. I never thought about that. I'm totally convinced that this is correct.
Good question. Why is the order of the pages, why does that change? Because now the Hebrew was on the left side and now it's on the right side.
Because of the way in which the art scroll is printed, the art scroll printing. In fact, if you take this Hebrew page here, this is the Hebrew, and then it's moving from an aleph side of the page to a bet side of the page on this particular one. Most of the time it doesn't do that. Most of the time it doesn't do that. But it just so happened we got to the end of an aleph side of a page, and then it went to the other page and it put it right on the opposite side, the way it would be in a normal Hebrew text.
Okay.
There's one more appropriate phrase.
The jealousy of Sofrim, again, whatever Sofrim means here, scholars, Marbe Chochma increases knowledge. But you have to watch out for scholars too, because they can bite. They can burn.
Ma is also knowledge.
Was there
science,
a difference in ancient
wisdom.
Israel between the priests and the teachers, or were they one and the same?
You mean very ancient Israel? That's at the time in the temple. What do you mean by the temple? Do you mean the temple, or do you mean before the temple? Do you mean? I'm going way back, because if you really mean ancient Israel normally refers to the Torah itself. Okay, so in the Torah itself, it seems that the priests had the role of what at a later time was scholars. Right? The priests carry the traditions. Most of the traditions are related to their activities. The Levites have some role in that too. Levites have roles. So I would say at the early time, the priests probably had that role.
Like in Egypt.
Well, I don't know about like in Egypt, but let's just say in the Torah.
Because
it may be quite different from Egypt, I think. But at a later time, one of the things that happens in Judaism is, how would we say it? It is a democratization of the priestly role. The late Rabbi Dr. Gerson Cohn, chancellor of the seminary in his day, wrote a wonderful article on the Talmudic period. He said that was the key thing that the Talmud did. It democratized access to religious experience. Because where you have religious experience that is limited to a priesthood, it's not democratic. Once you democratize it, as in this system where it becomes accessible. Anyone can, and they can rise in the ranks depending upon how well they do and how much they know. That's a completely different way of structuring a society. So one of the major impacts then of the whole Talmudic system is take religion and to move it out of the priesthood. When does that happen? It happens precisely in the period that we're reading about, because it happens with the Sofrim. Realize that the Sofrim, which go back now to Ezra, goes back to the period of the reconstruction of the temple. Okay, that's the Second Temple, early Second Temple period. So it must have been that by the early Second Temple period, we already have outside of the temple authorities who are the Sofrim. Right? Then we then have really two types of religious authority. We have the priest and we have the rabbi. Because prior to that, we probably had two types of authorities. There was the priest and there was the prophet. I realize that the prophetic tradition goes until the period of Ezra. It's at that point that the prophetic tradition stops, and there are no more prophets after that. And what takes the place of the prophet but the sage? The sage takes over for the prophet. And they're really quite different, but both of them are different from the priest.
Do you think the Kohanim resented the...
Oh, definitely.
They did.
There's tremendous tension with the Kohanim until finally the whole system gets destroyed. And that's the Hanukkah story.
Yeah, well, I know in later times, but you're talking now...
Oh, in early times? I mean, in the period of Ezra? That I don't know that there was tension.
Something
we know that
happened
there was
in Babylonian that's only one generation where they must have...
It could have been the...
Had to develop some...
Scholars speculate that the reality is it's the result of being outside of the land of Israel without any priestly place that you have to develop, or you might develop, and in fact they did develop, alternative methods of being religious. When you then go back to the place, you're different. And the place itself then functions differently.
Well, when you're in the country, you're under normal circumstances, far more nationalistic, or you pay more attention or equal attention to nationalism as to religion.
Correct. Let's go on. I'm going to finish up this section, if we can. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, another brayta now. Visamtem, and you shall place them, the words of the Torah, you shall place them. Samtem, you shall place them. Beficha, in your mouth. Okay? Let's see if they have a full quote here. Oh, sorry. Visamtem et divarai ela alavavchem ve'al nafshechem. I quoted that wrong. You shall place these words of mine upon your heart and upon your soul. Visamtem. Now, the Baraita says as follows. Takes the word samtem and divides it in two. Samtam. Mm-hmm. Samtam. Sam is a drug. Here it's translated in a rather parva fashion as an elixir. Today you're not allowed to use the word. There are no more drug companies. Only pharmaceutical companies. Drugs in English today has a bad overtone to it. So in the Talmud, didn't yet have that overtone. Samtam means a perfect drug. Nimshalat Torah kasam chayim. The Torah is compared to a drug that gives you life, that brings you back to life. Mashali Adam Shihikad Beno Makagadola. This can be compared to a man who dealt his son a great blow. Right? He hit his son. Vihiniach lo ritia al makato. And he then placed a poultice on it, a compress upon the wound. Vi'amar lo, and he said to him, Bini kolzman shaharitia zo al makatcha. As long as the compress is on your wound, echol ma bahanaatcha, eat whatever you like. In other words, you don't have to worry about the impact of what you eat on getting better. I have given you the thing that will take care of your wound. Shteima shahada adcha. Drink whatever you want. Urechotz ben bechamim ben mitzonein. Wash yourself with hot water or with cold water. In other words, this is a miracle medicine that I've placed on this. You don't have to worry about anything once you've once I've placed this miracle medicine on the wound. The enatam mitjarei, you have nothing to worry about. The imata ma'avira, but if you remove this compress, harehi ma'ale nomi, you will surely have pus in its place. Okay? All right. So what are we talking about here? What's this? Is a mashal? It's a parable. Kacha Kadosh Baruch Hu Amar Lahem LiYisrael. So the Holy One, blessed be He, said to them, to Israel, Banai, my sons, Barati Yetzar Hara, I created the evil influence. I wounded you. Namely, you were created with a problem, and I put it in there. Uvarati lo Torah tavlin, but I created for you the Torah as the way to deal with that problem. The ima temoskim b'Torah, if you involve yourselves with Torah study, enatem nimsarim biado, you will not be delivered into its hand. In other words, the Yetzer Hara will never get the best of you. Shneamar, halo im teitiv se'et. This is now quoting the story in the beginning of Genesis about Adam and Eve. And finally, Cain and Abel. And Cain says, you know, who am I? I'm my brother's keeper. And God says to him, he has a whole response, hello, im teitiv se'et, if you do well, you will be lifted up, you will prevail. Ve'im ein atem oskim b'Torah, but if you do not busy yourselves with the Torah, atem nimsarim biado, you are handed into the hands of the Yetzer Hara, of the evil inclination. Shneamar, lapetach chatat rovetz. Those are the words of the Torah. At the door, sin crouches. Sin crouches at the door. V'lo od ele shekol masa'o matanobach. And what is more, all of his pursuits, the evil inclination's pursuits, are to get at you. Shneamar, as it says, de'elecha teshukato, you are its desire. De'im ata rotzeh ata moshel bo, but if you wish, you can master it. As it says, Beatatim shall bo, you shall conquer it. That's the end of that verse in the book of Genesis. This, by the way, is the source of one of the greatest books in the English language. The book East of Eden by John Steinbeck is based exactly on this baraita. Steinbeck has this incredible story about the nature of evil. And finally, he has a Chinese man who heard it from a rabbi. And this, he quotes exactly what we have quoted here, exactly as we have quoted it here, in fact, in the Baraita, to say that this is the basis of all of our humanity. Is that sin crouches at the door, and you can, if you will allow yourself, if you correct, im teitiv se'et, if you try to be good, you are able to prevail. That's the human condition. That's the very nature of the human condition. But sin is always there. It doesn't mean that you must give in to sin. But sin is always there as a temptation. And none of us, no human being, is free from sin. This is the way one is created. Okay. Questions, comments?
How does that compare to the Christian notion that we are born in sin by default? And
Well, that's a good question. How does it compare to the Christian notion? The truth is, I don't really know. And I'll tell you why. I used to think it was very easy to answer that question. Christians believed in original sin. The Jews did not. Until I read Reinhold Niebuhr's The Nature and Destiny of Man. Any of you ever read Reinhold Niebuhr? Mm-hmm. One of the great theologians of the 20th century. Great Protestant theologian. Taught at the Union Theological Seminary. He has a two-volume work, which is, to my mind, the greatest piece of theological literature in the 20th century, The Nature and Destiny of Man.
The nature of what?
Nature and Destiny of Man. Niebuhr, in the second volume of that, has a long, long, long study of original sin in Christianity. And his notion of original sin in Christianity is, to my mind, exactly like our notion of the Yetzer Hara. That's what he says. So whether he is misinterpreting Christianity or correctly interpreting Christianity, far be it from me to say. So once I read Niebuhr, I stopped saying what I used to say. I knew it was more complicated because I saw the Christians themselves were arguing over this very same issue. So it's not such a simple thing as far as I can see. In the 20th century, Jewish arguments were always Christianity said this, Judaism said the opposite. Christianity said that man was born evil, and Judaism is man was born with a potential for good, at least. Either good or for the potential for good. But I'm not sure that either of those statements is as accurate as it used to seem to me.
I think Christianity believes in a force that opposes God actively in the world. It's not a part of human nature. It's a Satan or the devil is as active in the world as is God in heaven.
And so what is Satan?
So what?
What is Satan?
Well, in one form, it's the
serpent
in the Garden of
Eden. To some extent, it may be that the best way to understand Satan is as the Yetzer Hara.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying, right?
Yeah, no.
Our notions that we have from Christian art of the anthropomorphic nature of Satan, I think, is only Christian art. I'm not sure that they really believe that at all.
Absolutely. They believe in hell and heaven. Satan is the...
But we do too. That's the thing.
Yeah, but that's creates duality. That takes away from monotheism.
But we've got a lot of that
too.
Theologically. We also, and remember the Talmud has heaven and hell. It doesn't work exactly the way as theirs does. But I saw some use to see today. I was looking through my mail and I came while I was away and saw the 92nd Street Y. They sent out their bulletin. And what is the Jewish institution, the 92nd Street Young Men Hebrews Association? Mm-hmm. They have a course this next semester in the Paradiso of Dante. So if you really want to know about heaven, where you have to go today is the 92nd Street one. Yeah, well, they say that this course presupposes that you already have read and understood the Inferno and the Purgatorio.
It is okay.
Yes. I have a question about the way the printing in the book is. Certain paragraphs have all capitals and certain paragraphs do not. Is there some significance to that?
The all capitals, you mean in the English printing?
Yes.
The English printing, all capitals are where the English is translating the Hebrew text. Where you have something other than all capitals, then you are looking at something other than a translation of the text. If it's in italics, it's usually a quote from the scriptures. If it's upper and lower case together, it's usually the editor of the art scroll adding something to the text to clarify something the editor wants to clarify. Okay? Look at that. I think that's pretty consistent. I think it's probably quite consistent. Are you convinced?
I couldn't tell the difference between the bold upper and lower case and the all caps. Of course, then they also have the not bold text, which seems to be interpolated or implied. They're saying it's implicit in filling in the gaps to make.
I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. That's a good point. I don't know the answer. I see what you're pointing out, yeah. It seems inconsistent. It seems inconsistent. Maybe it's not. I don't know the answer.
Okay? I looked in the beginning to see if there was a note.
Yeah, no, I don't know. To be continued, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Welcome back.
Rabbi, can I ask you? Not thank you. Not related to this. My father and his wife found out about this group called SAR-L. He said I would find out anything I could ask.